Okay, so the main focus of this course is going to be on the connections between particle physics and cosmology. And first of all, I want to ask, how many people here took the Beyond the Standard Model course that David Morrissey taught? Okay, how many of you have taken the Standard Model review course? Okay, most of you. Good. And how many of you took the cosmology review course? Good. Okay. So if you were in David's course, you already heard a little bit about some of the speculative theories beyond the Standard Model. The reason why in this explorations course we're going to talk about dark matter is motivated by our understanding or lack thereof of what makes up most of the content of the universe. So if we draw a pie chart, which indicates the relative amounts of energy that we have in the universe, what we find is that most of it is made up of dark energy. This is about 68%. Then this next larger chunk here is dark matter. This is about 27%. And then the last small component is baryonic matter, which includes the subdominant components like electrons and photons. The largest component are from a nucleon. And so obviously what's interesting about this is that everything that you heard about in your standard model course is encompassed in this small 5% wedge here. But there's a lot that we don't understand. And even within this small wedge of baryonic matter, there's a key question that is outstanding, which is that everything that we see around us is made up of matter, protons and electrons, and not antimatter. So unless you work hard to create it, you don't see antiprotons and antielectrons. And the standard model that you have hopefully learned about already is more or less symmetric with respect to matter versus antimatter. Okay, there's only a small amount of violation of this. And so even this small wedge, we don't understand why it looks the way it does. Now, we're going to neglect this seemingly big question of dark energy. Part of that is because it really is mostly due to the connection between particle physics and gravity. And because that's at a pretty inaccessible scale, there's a lot of different ways that you could resolve this. So for instance, in classical GR, we could just have a cosmological constant. I can just say that's what it is. And then that's the end of the story. So we're mostly going to focus on these pieces here, and in particular in dark matter. The kinds of questions that we're going to ask are, and hopefully address, are things like, is dark matter a particle like everything else that we see? In other words, is there just sort of a dark version of the standard model? If so, what are the properties of these particles? So what kinds of particles are there, their masses, their interactions, all the things that we normally classify the standard model in terms of. And then perhaps most importantly, we're interested in the connections with the standard model. So there's this other dark universe out there. How does it interact with our universe? And from what we know about dark matter, are there hints about what those connections could be? And then finally, how do we actually test this? Because ideally, we want there to be some experimental confirmation of our ideas. Otherwise, it's just speculation. One of the reasons why in the past 2 years, this part of the course is focused on dark matter is because dark matter is one of the few places where we know that there has to be physics beyond the standard model. So if you've taken the BSM course, you know that there are all kinds of other motivations for physics beyond the standard model, such as that there's this hierarchy problem. We don't understand why the Higgs mass is very light compared to the Planck scale. There's questions about flavor. You know, we don't understand why the top quark is heavier than the up quark and things like this. But at the end of the day, these are speculative questions. They're based on, I have some philosophy of what my theory should look like, and the theory doesn't seem to look like that. Whereas with this question of dark matter, there's literally nothing that we can have in the standard model that can address this question. So from that perspective, if we can figure out what dark matter is, then we definitely have a handle into what new physics there is beyond the standard model. Yes?
So I know that you're not going to cover dark energy, but I have just one question related to particle physics.
Okay.
Does a standard model predict a particular value of dark energy?
Yeah, well, that depends. So the way that we think about it is that particle physics, so you know, the standard model, each of the particles contributes a vacuum energy, which is proportional to these you know, bubble diagrams, which you can compute and are divergent, so you can put a cutoff in. So usually the Planck scale is put as a cutoff. So you can treat that as a prediction, but there's always the contributions of the various standard model particles in the group plus some tree-level term lambda. So if this is a free parameter in my theory, I can just fix it so that it cancels out the other stuff and gives me the observed value. So that's just what I mean by, in principle, dark energy can be included. We don't understand why it's much smaller than the Planck scale, but once again, that becomes a question of, do you believe in fine-tuning, do you, you know, all of these kinds of things. Of course, another thing that we do know is that gravity is not renormalizable. So there's probably something that happens up at the Planck scale, but it's very hard to figure out what's happening there. Okay. On a more practical level, another thing that's interesting about thinking about dark matter and more generally connections between particle physics and cosmology is that it's sort of an interesting playground where we get to look at different ideas and learn about different things in particle physics. So hopefully you'll cover and review a lot of the things you learned in your earlier courses, and you'll be applying them to something that actually can answer some of the big questions that we have. So the general outline of the course. So today is going to focus on just how do we know dark matter is there and what are its properties. Then we're going to talk about how we can connect a theory of particle physics to what was going on in the early universe. So that's going to focus on how do we determine the abundances and rates of various interactions in the early universe. And this will be somewhat of a review for those of you who have taken the cosmology course. I'll then talk about what's perhaps the leading dark matter candidate, which is called weakly interacting particle dark matter. Massive particle. It's called a WIMP. So we'll look at what are the what is WIMP dark matter? Why is it a viable dark matter candidate? What are the properties it has in the models that are out there for it? Then we'll look at the probes of WIMP dark matter. So this is where we really test the particle properties of dark matter by saying if it's the dark matter candidate, we know it interacts in various ways, and so we can look for it in the lab. For instance, we can put a chunk of material out and look for the dark matter to come and hit it, or we can look for some effects of dark matter annihilation out astrophysically, and so on. So this is going to include various things. So it's going to be dark matter at colliders, so-called direct detection, where we look for its scattering directly, indirect detection, where we look for its annihilation. And one of the nice things about WIMP dark matter is that it sort of makes predictions for all of these things. And because each of them, seeing a signal doesn't necessarily tell you it's dark matter. If you see kind of a concordance of different signals, then you can put it together and tell you about what dark matter is. Finally, we'll talk about other kinds of dark matter, which all sort of collectively lump together in non-thermal dark matter and non-WIMP dark matter. So this is going to be different production mechanisms or different properties. So for instance, in WIMP dark matter, usually dark matter doesn't interact with itself, but you can add in self-interaction, that changes its properties. You can have it very weakly coupled, and this gives rise to different kinds of signatures. Okay, so before we start in with a review of what dark matter is and why we know it's there, are there any questions about the kind of general motivation? Yes?
When you say weakly interacting, does that mean interacting by the weak force or some other?
Yeah, so that's the original motivation. It means either interacting via the weak force or interacting via a force that has the strength of the weak. And we'll see in a couple of days why that is the prediction. So people were initially excited because it turns out that if you just put in a new stable particle that interacts with a strength about the weak force and it has a mass around the weak scale, it gives you the right dark matter abundance just automatically by this so-called WIMP miracle. And we'll go into quite a bit of detail on how that comes about. The problem is that we haven't seen any evidence for a new particle that's charged under the weak interaction. So it might not literally be weakly interacting, but it's kind of like a weakly interacting particle. But that's a good question. Any other questions? Right. So today, it's mostly going to be in two parts. One is we're going to look at evidence for dark matter. Because otherwise, you might ask why we're even bothering to do this. And we're going to look at two different scales. One of them is on cosmological scales. So what this tells us is that dark matter isn't just some local weird thing that's happening close by. It's something that is present everywhere in the universe. And then we'll also look at galactic scales. Namely, that we can actually observe dark matter's effects on the movement of astrophysical objects. Second, we'll look at the dark matter hypothesis that we'll be using for the rest of the course. And this will then set up what kinds of properties we expect dark matter to have and point us in the direction of certain theories for dark matter. Okay, so let's start with evidence. And in particular, start with the cosmology side. And by far the most important probe that we have of dark matter in the early universe is the cosmic microwave background. And the cosmic microwave background is the oldest light that we have in the universe. And so the fact that we can see the imprint of dark matter tells us that dark matter had to be present even then. And it tells us a lot about what the kinds of interactions dark matter can have with the standard model. So we can imagine that the universe was some hot thermal plasma after the Big Bang, where there were lots of different particles. And then it eventually, as time passed, it goes to later time, and the temperature cools down. And of course, we know that there are things like protons and electrons at low energies. So as the energy cools down to, say, a few eV or so, we have these protons and electrons just flying everywhere. Okay. Once the universe cools to a sufficiently low quantity, these things will bind up into hydrogen atoms, where this is in orbit. So we know that the binding energy for this is about 13 electron volts. So if these things have a kinetic energy that's more than 13 electron volts, they're never going to stick together. They're just going to keep swimming around. And while they're free, we have a bunch of charged particles. And so these are exchanging photons. And there's a huge number of photons. There's something like number of photons, the number of electrons, about 10 to the 10th, which is just because we have so many charged particles in the early universe. And then once they cool down here, suddenly we have neutral atoms. And these photons are typically very low energy, so very long wavelength. And so the photons don't see the fact that there's individual electrons or protons. They just see this net neutral atom. So what you get is that once you pass into this phase, instead of having the photons interacting with things, they just stream outwards, because there's no longer anything for them to talk to. And this outward streaming of the photons is the cosmic microwave background. And it was one of the clearest signals that there was a Big Bang. Because when we look in the sky, we do, in fact, see this huge bath of uniform radiation at a temperature of 2.73 Kelvin. So this is light that's coming from the very earliest stages where this process of, it's called recombination, but really it's just combination is happening. And so if we can measure the properties of these photons, then this tells us something about what the universe was doing at that time. Okay, so what were the main constituents of the sort of the plasma while you're moving from this stage to this stage? We have protons, electrons, and photons. The electrons are going to be subdominant because they're so much lighter. So we're just going to ignore them for now. And so what you get is you have a bunch of protons, and you have a gas of photons is interacting with them. And when these protons come close together, there's a radiation pressure that exists just because you have this very high density of photons. And so what you end up with is the photons sort of act like springs. that connect the different protons together. And so what you can get are waves in the plasma, which are just sound waves. They're compressive waves associated with the fact that there are these photons going everywhere. And so if there were any perturbations in the early universe, then the result is you get these vibrational waves that are transmitted at characteristic frequencies. And we do know that there had to be some perturbations. The reason is that we exist. And so if the universe was completely homogeneous, it would stay completely homogeneous. Whereas we know that there were tiny little pockets of overdensity and underdensity, and those eventually clumped together to form everything that we have. So what we end up with are a set of acoustic oscillations. And so what you can look for are imprints of these sound waves in the cosmic microwave background. Now, why does this matter from the perspective of whether there's dark matter or not? Well, if there's no dark matter and the only thing that you have are these protons and photons, this tends to suppress any kind of growth of the perturbations, the reason being that even if you have a bunch of protons clumped together, they get blown apart by the forces between them. So at this point, even though they're very, very small perturbations, you don't end up with any significant growth of structure. However, if we have something that doesn't talk to either the protons or the photons, then gravity starts to make it clump together. So we have this sort of uniform bath of protons and photons, and then we get these little clumps of whatever this other particle is, which I'm just going to call dark matter because it doesn't interact with photons, and these grow with time because there's no other force acting on them. Gravity just pulls more and more things into these different structures here. So this means is that it's not like we have just protons with springs acting between them, but we actually have a structure that looks more like this. We have some potential well. This is the dark matter gravitational potential. And the protons sort of slide in and out of these potential wells. And if you remember from your first mechanics class, if you have something that's oscillating from a spring, but you have it, say, in a gravitational potential, so you're hanging it from something, it tends to, instead of just being even oscillations, it tends to have, for instance, the inward gravitational force makes more compression than the rarefaction going the other direction. And so it distorts the relative oscillations. So instead of just free oscillations, you end up with something that oscillates more on one part of the oscillation and less on the other part of the oscillation. So the number of baryons to, say, number of dark matter is imprinted in the relative oscillation peaks. So if we can look at the oscillation of different modes, the compression and the rarefaction modes, we should see different heights associated with them. Now, how do we actually see this? What we actually see are, we have, say, for a very simple picture, plane waves of these oscillations, which are traveling in certain directions, say. We are at a very unexceptional part of the universe. We're just some random dot. And you can measure the horizon associated with the cosmic microwave background by some circle that it takes light, you know, c times this distance in order to reach the present day. And so what we see are, let's say these are the peaks, and these are the troughs. Then when we look at different angles, we see, for instance, in this angle, there's going to be a peak, and in this angle, there's a trough. And we can figure out the wave structure by correlating, you know, how far apart these two peaks are in angular space. So this corresponds to basically trying to map the sphere, where we're looking at things in all different directions and saying, okay, well, if I can say that some particular angle I look at, I end up seeing two hot spots. This tells me something about the frequencies. And indeed, what you can do is you can do sort of like a Fourier decomposition, but in angular space. So you essentially take your mapping of the hot and cold spots of the CMB, and you decompose them in terms of spherical harmonics. And what you end up with is something that looks like this. So on the y-axis, we have the power, which is normalized in a certain way. And we have these L values, which is the angular momentum associated with each of the spherical harmonics. And you do indeed see that there are peaks and troughs associated with these different oscillations. We see a big peak here, and we see a little peak, then we see another little peak, which is almost as high, and then it squiggles down. So this is the first compression peak. This is the first rarefaction peak, second compression, et cetera, et cetera. All right, so how do we interpret this spectrum in terms of this oscillating things inside of the potential well? We said that one of the characteristics of baryons oscillating in a dark matter well is that the compression peaks tend to be more pronounced than the rarefaction peaks. And indeed, you see something that looks like this. So for instance, the first compression one is high, then we have a small peak. There's some damping associated with this, so you expect all the peaks to get lower and lower. So the fact that the second compression peak is basically as high, or maybe a little bit higher, as the first rarefaction peak tells us that this effect is really there, that there's something that's pulling the baryons in more than is pushing them out. So the fact that these two peaks are so comparable tells us that there's something non-baryonic. And not just non-baryonic, but there's something that is not coupled to the same photon bath. Okay, so we need to have something that's very weakly coupled at this stage that's causing this effect. Now, this isn't a cosmology class. I'm not going to get into all the different parameters you can look for, but needless to say, there are various degeneracies. So it's not, I'm painting an overly simplistic picture in that there are various other cosmological parameters that I could tweak that give rise to similar effects. And so really what you have to do is you have to look at various observations and try to break the degeneracies associated with this. Okay. So the thing that we want to pin down is the entries on this pie chart. So we're going to define the fractional energy density in each component I with the energy density in component I compared with what's called the critical density. And we'll see what that is in tomorrow's lecture. But this is basically, if the universe is flat, which it looks to be, how much energy is in each component. So it's just, like I said, the things that are on that pie chart. And it turns out we can break the degeneracies between, say, the number of baryons, the amount of matter, and the amount of dark energy. So this omega baryon, it's known to be about 0.05. Okay. This comes from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, basically the fact that in the early universe you had free protons and neutrons and you want to form the correct amounts of hydrogen, helium, lithium, etc. So this is a number that's pinned down fairly well. And then using various other measurements, we can break the degeneracy between this omega dark energy and omega matter, so this is the total matter. And so you get various different curves. What you find, so here, 0.3, this is about 0.7, that the CMB forms sort of some best fit contour here. Supernovae form another contour, and a different observation called the baryon acoustic oscillations, which is just a measurement of how this oscillation is imprinted just in sort of how different areas of the sky have, if you count the number of galaxies, how that's correlated. You see that there's some region here. Let's see. That there's some region here where they all overlap. And so we can use these measurements from the CMB to determine exactly how much total matter there is, how much dark energy, and because omega dark matter is omega matter minus omega baryons. This gives us about 27% or so dark matter. Yes, Tibra.
Do you just I think that corner is not visible from.
Oh yeah, that's right. Let me lift this up. I'm pretty much done with this one. Oh, now the speaker's in front of it. Can people see this? Yes, good enough. Okay. Right, so the main point of this is just to illustrate that at the very earliest times where we see light coming from, there's evidence of something that's clumping that's not interacting with the baryons. And that's what we're going to call dark matter. And this is something that's very hard to get around because there wasn't really a whole lot of extra stuff happening at the time of the CMB. The measured anisotropy at that stage is about one part in 100,000 or so. So the universe was a pretty even place. And so it's hard to think up of things, this is just when hydrogen atoms were forming. And so originally people thought that maybe dark matter was actually just clumps of normal baryonic matter. The CMB tells us this can't be the case because otherwise you wouldn't be able to explain these relative peak structure. Okay. Are there any questions about this and what it tells us about dark matter? Okay, so you're not really going to have to worry too much about the CMB from this point onwards in case some of the details are tricky. We're just basically going to take the CMB as an input and say, okay, we now know the fraction of the universe that's dark matter, and this is a target that we're going to go for. So this is all well and good, but you might say, well, how well do we really understand what the universe was doing at the early times? I mean, it seems to work pretty well cosmologically, but if this dark matter was there, and if it's really more dominant than the regular matter, we should be able to see its effects otherwise. And so that brings us to the second topic, which is local or galactic effects. So the fact that even though it's dark, we can't actually see it. So remember that at very early times, we started with this homogeneous bath, but the dark matter started clumping. Well, that, of course, continues on to later and later times. And the dark matter clumps very severely, and it ends up forming the backbone around which galaxies form. Okay, so what you have is that the dark matter sort of clumps in the early universe, form halos at late time. And then these in turn lead to galaxy formation. So what we expect is at the center of every galaxy, there should be a large quantity of dark matter. And so what we want to do is figure out, okay, well, how do we test the amount of matter that's in the center of galaxies? Stuff is in galaxies. So there are two ways that we can do it. One is that we can just measure the amount and distribution of starlight and gases and whatnot. And this gives us a direct probe of the amount of visible matter that's inside of the galaxies. The second thing that we can do is the fact that there's some stuff concentrated at the center of the galaxy causes the stuff on the outside of the galaxy to rotate. So we can look at the rotational properties and infer how much matter there was. So what we do is we measure the velocity distribution. And then we can just use the simple formula from kinematics, from your first physics class, that v squared over r is equal to g m of r over r squared. So this is just Newtonian mechanics. M of r is the amount of mass enclosed in R. Okay. So what we're going to do is look at the velocity of galaxies and stuff that's rotating as a function of R from those galaxies. The way that we do that is that we look at galaxies that, say, have a disk structure, and they're going to be rotating. And so if we're looking at it in this direction, the matter that is going away from us, the light is going to be redshifted, but the light, the matter that's coming towards us, the light it emits, is going to be blue shifted. So there's going to be a relative Doppler shift between a point that's the same distance r here and r there. So what we can do is we can just make a lot of these measurements, and what this does is it gives us a function of the velocity as a function of radius. So we look for the Doppler shift. Since v is a function of r, here's r. And what you predict from the amount of visible light is something that looks like this, where there's this initial sort of bulge of stuff that's in the middle, and so this gives rise to a very rapid rotation, and then as you go further out, the distribution of visible matter falls off, and so you end up with a curve that looks like this. This is a visible matter prediction. What's actually observed is something that looks like this. So indeed, in the inner part of the galaxy, it follows the curve very well, but then it actually flattens out. So the fact that there's a difference between the actual curve and the prediction tells us that the mass that is enclosed by a sphere of radius r is actually much bigger than the visible matter would tell us. So this tells us there's extra mass that's not visible. And this is convenient because from the CMB, we've already seen that there should be some large quantity of stuff that is not visible. And here, we've been able to infer its existence just from observing the motion of bodies under its gravitational influence. Now, I should point out at this stage that there are alternatives to dark matter from this side of the story. One of them, which is something that people here probably think a little bit about, is modifying gravity. The reason being that this is some assumption from Newtonian mechanics. And so if Newtonian mechanics is wrong and I change my F equals ma relationship, then I'm going to change the relative prediction. Okay? And so maybe if I change my law of gravity, instead of following this trajectory, I can follow this trajectory instead. And there are some candidates to do this. There's something called modified Newtonian dynamics, and there are a few other things. The problem with these modified gravity models from our perspective is that there's no way to do a consistent cosmology. I would hesitate to call them models. They're more kind of proposed scaling relations or modifications of Newtonian gravity. But we know, for instance, that Newtonian gravity is actually some limit of GR, and it's kind of tricky to get this kind of dynamics out of modifications of GR. So it's a big open question in these modified gravity theories of what does the CMB predict? Because we know that there's this very non-trivial prediction of the CMB for these different peak structures. And so if this modified gravity picture is going to be correct, then the normal baryonic stuff that's going at the time of recombination should give you this same peak structure. And at the moment, it's not known how to do that. So from that perspective, modified gravity doesn't actually, isn't able to confirm like what's going on the cosmological side. And so most people who work in cosmology and particle physics just take that the dark matter hypothesis is probably the correct way to go, keeping in mind that as techniques improve for studying these modified dynamics, it would be interesting to see what happens on the cosmological side. Okay, interesting. Okay. So are there any questions about the observation of dark matter from this side of things?
Yes. Ask something about something you said previously.
Sure. Yeah.
So, what would we expect in the absence of dark matter for the peaks and troughs there on the top right?
So you would expect the third peak to be quite a bit lower than the second one. So there's some damping associated with it, just because you're looking at different higher harmonics, so they get more washed out in the propagation. So you sort of, just like how the first and the second peak are sort of high and low relative to one another, you expect the second peak to be a bit higher, the third peak to be a bit lower, and so on. Again, it's because of this effect where the baryons are either loaded into this dark matter potential or not, in which case the oscillation structure looks very different. Does that answer your question?
Those peaks are supposed to be coming from compression and rarefaction in this of these
that's
protons?
Right. That's right, yeah. Because you, I should be careful that I say about compression and rarefaction, because of course, rarefaction of the stuff at the bottom of the potential is compression of something at the top of the potential. So
if there were a flat potential, what would you expect?
So you'd still expect to see peaks, but they would, instead of having a hierarchical structure so that, say, the first and third peaks are higher than the second and fourth ones, you get that they should all basically be the same. Because there's nothing that spatially distinguishes the things that are compressed at the bottom of the well versus compressed at the top of the well. So understanding the CMB spectrum is quite an evolved thing. So I mean, don't worry about kind of getting all the details. It's just the general picture of appreciating the fact that physically there's a difference between springs oscillating inside of a potential well and springs not oscillating inside of a potential well. That's basically the upshot of it. Like I said, there are various other effects that you have to take into account that can mimic this, and so you need to understand the full kind of traction to assure yourself that this is what's going on, but that this is what the CMB is seeing. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so before we move on to the dark matter hypothesis, I just want to mention one other way that we have actually seen directly the effects of dark matter, and this is not on the galactic scale, but on the galactic cluster scale. So this is just a little bit bigger. And there was about 10 or 15 years ago the observation of something called the Bullitt cluster. And the Bullitt cluster is actually observing two colliding galactic clusters. So the before picture, which is something that we sort of have to pretend we see because we don't actually see a before picture, we just see what's actually happening, is that we have two galaxy clusters that are colliding with one another. And just like on galactic scales, these clusters form around some backbone of dark matter. So there's a bunch of galaxies here. Each of them is made up of a dark matter component and a visible component. And they, you know, they look sort of like this, that there's some dark matter halo in the center. So both of them are dark matter plus visible matter. If we look at them today, however, what we see is very interesting, which is we see, and by see, I mean directly see, two dark matter halos going in opposite directions, away from one another. And then we see some region in the center that has the visible matter. Okay. The visible matter we can see from X-ray emissions and various things that are going on there. But the dark matter, we have to rely on gravitational lensing to see the dark matter. But what's interesting is that the actual concentration of most of the matter in the galaxy clusters is completely separate from where we're seeing the visible matter. This is very different from what's happening on the galactic scales, where the dark matter and visible matter are sort of sitting right on top of each other. It's just that there happens to be more dark matter than visible matter. Here, there's actually been a separation of them. And what this tells us is that the visible matter, it's charged under electromagnetism. And so it's sticky in some sense. But there's some interactions between the ionized gas there, and it tends to hold the visible matter together. The dark matter, no interaction, and so it just passes through as if nothing were happening. Should point out that the Bullitt cluster is also a very difficult thing to explain from the perspective of modified gravity, because it literally separates the gravitational potential from the visible matter. It's not just saying it has a different shape. So this is interesting because it's, yes?
So like this kind of mechanism would like strip dark matter away from galaxies in some sense, like at least separate them.
Yeah.
So why don't we see like most dark matter halos separated from galaxies?
I think because it's quite rare for this kind of collision process to happen. Because most of the universe is empty space, and so, and I think you need, to have, you know, the shapes need to be right and they need to collide head on, and you know, this sort of thing has to happen. There have been a few other measurements of colliding galaxy clusters, but you're right that this tells us something about the dynamics of galaxy formation, that you can't have too much of this happening or else it would strip away the dark matter from the baryons. The other thing is that, of course, this depends somewhat on the individual process, but because most of the matter is in the dark matter, eventually you imagine that there's some, you know, some of the matter will be pulled back into the dark matter potential. So we don't know how long this effect lasts. We're just very lucky that we actually saw the snapshot of it. Okay? So this is an intrinsically interesting observation, but it also tells us another thing about dark matter, which is that dark matter has to have no or a very weak interaction. The interaction has to be much weaker than electromagnetism, the reason being that if dark matter self-interacted too much, it would also get stuck together in the middle. So we can use this to narrow down the different options that we have for what dark matter can be. All right. So are there any questions about the Bullock cluster or any of the other stuff we talked about?
What's the actual distribution of the dark matter in the galaxies? Does it rise?
So this is consistent with, I mean, we can sort of see it here where V is flat. This is consistent with a R cubed, no, sorry, like a 1 over R kind of distribution. It actually turns out that there's sort of most dark matter simulations give you like a break in the dark matter distribution. So there's a very peaked intersection, which goes like 1 over R-ish, and then there's a 1 over R cubed section out of far distances. And then the net effect is that it gives you something like this. So I should say that the mass distribution has to go like R. Of course, if mass is V3R of rho, goes like R, then rho, it's like 1 over R squared. So we can kind of infer a general 1 over R squared type behavior, but it turns out that it's the best predictions are somewhat different from a simple 1 over R squared. But yeah, it's kind of weird to think, like this tells you that the dark matter extends out very, very large distances. And it's also approximately spherically symmetric, which the disk is not. So that's sort of another feature. Let's see, okay. So let's talk about particle physics now. We want to know what these properties tell us about the theory of what dark matter can be. So what we hypothesize is the existence of a new particle. I should say that there could be more than one as well, but for simplicity, we often take one. And the properties that it has to have are, it has to be non-luminous. So what do we mean by non-luminous? It needs to be dark in the sense that it's not strongly coupled to the photon path at the time of the CMB, and it doesn't give off a lot of light for all of these different probes. So what this generally means is no large coupling to the electromagnetic gauge interaction. Of course, you could always put a very, very tiny coupling, and so there are some constraints on what that is, but it can't be the same size as, say, electrons or protons or something like this. It also should not be charged under the strong interaction. It's SU3 color. And the reason for this is that you can get processes where you have like dark matter goes to pions, and the pions decay to photons. So even if it's not charged under electromagnetism, we do know that some neutral, strongly interacting particles do decay into photons. And so collisions and whatnot of these processes will generally give you some kind of photons. Also, I should point out that if it's charged under SU3 color, it's probably also excluded by these constraints on self-interaction from the Bullock cluster. Okay. It should be feebly, at most, self-interacting. And this is mostly from the bullet cluster. So this tells us, it doesn't tell us that there can't be dark matter self-interaction. So we could imagine that the dark sector has a dark matter particle and it has its own gauge interactions and various things. But we need to bear in mind that it needs to be sufficiently low that the particles just pass through each other. Another property is that it has to be long-lived or stable. The reason being that we see it now. So this tells us that the lifetime should be bigger than about 10 billion years. So it's possible the dark matter is only metastable and it's decaying sort of as we speak, and we're seeing some subdominant fraction. And part of the reason is that the CMB is the best measure of the amount of dark matter that we that's in the universe. These kinds of things, it's hard to extract the total number density. But this is a very, very long lifetime. Okay, so this is another condition that has to be met. And finally, it has to be cold. And the reason is that, so I should first tell you what cold means. It means non-relativistic at structure formation. And the reason for this is simple, that one of our main probes is the CMB. It relies on the fact that dark matter is clumping together. But if it's relativistic, the dominant energy is kinetic, and it doesn't like to clump together. It'll just keep streaming out. So both from the perspective of the CMB and other measurements of how early structure is forming, you can't have it be non-relativistic at the time of structure formation. Okay. Are there any questions about any of these conditions? All right, so the first,
Is there any more complicated scenario that allows it to have like relativistic dark matter during structure formation, or there's like definitely no scenario?
Yeah, not really. So you can definitely have relativistic components of dark matter. So that's usually called dark radiation. So you can certainly have that in your theory, but the lower limits on the dark matter mass are typically in the KeV range, which are coming from this, assuming that it was in thermal equilibrium. So yeah, this is a pretty strong constraint. So one thing that you can ask is, and people did ask this, was when they were first firming up the fact that there was dark matter, you know, what are some good dark matter candidates in the standard model? One of them are neutrinos. But neutrinos are relativistic, and when they started doing simulations of how structure forms, they found that it completely doesn't agree with any observations. So that was sort of the first hint that you can't have relativistic dark matter. So what I just mentioned is exactly what people first tried to do, which is, you know, we have this standard model. Can one of the standard model particles be dark matter? That's the simplest proposal. And there are a few neutral particles in the standard model. There's a Z boson, there's a photon, there's a neutrino, and there's a neutron. So let's go through each of them. The Z boson has a lifetime of about 10 to the minus 25 seconds. So that's no good. It's about 50 orders of magnitude off what we need. The photon is relativistic. So that's no good. The neutrino is also relativistic. And then the neutron, the lifetime is like a few seconds or something like that. So these are the only neutral particles we have in the standard model, and they're all either unstable or relativistic. So this immediately tells us that we need to have a new particle in our theory, that none of the standard model candidates are okay. So we can ask, what scale does that new particle have to be in? So what we'll do is draw all of the scales that we know can exist in terms of particle physics and cosmology. So here on the left, we're going to start with the Hubble scale. And on the right, we're going to go up to the Planck scale. So this is the possible mass of the dark matter candidate in GeV. The Planck scale is about 10 to the 19 GeV. And the Hubble scale is about 10 to the minus 41 GeV. So the reason why the dark matter mass has to be bigger than the Hubble is that otherwise the Compton wavelength doesn't fit into the observable universe. And so that's a problem from the perspective of trying to keep dark matter here. So this suggests that there's about 60 orders of magnitude of mass that we can have. And it turns out that the answer isn't quite so bad, that it's actually a little bit more restrictive, which is that there's a scale here which is kiloparsec scale. This is the galactic scale. So we can say, well, we've observed dark matter localized to galaxies. So this means that dark matter has to have a mass that's bigger than about 10 to the minus 33 GeV. But hopefully this goes to illustrate the challenge of identifying what dark matter is, because we still have some 50 orders of magnitude of mass range. And of course, at each different mass range, how dark matter is produced and how it interacts is going to be very different. Now, it turns out that there's still another narrowing, and this is at 10 to the minus 7 GeV. This is called the Tremaine-Gunn bound. And what it basically comes down to is that, of course, if I have a fixed energy density of rho, this basically goes like the mass of the dark matter times the number density of the dark matter. So if I go to a lower mass, I have a higher density. And if I have fermions, I can pack them in and pack them in, and eventually I hit the limit from Pauli exclusion principle, that I have some galaxy and I just can't fit any more fermions into that. Okay. And so that's what this Tremaine-Gunn bound is. It applies to fermions only. So if you have a fermion, it has to have a mass that's about a keV, 0.1 keV or bigger. Okay. And then we'll draw in here the Higgs mass, which is 125 GeV. So the paradigm of weakly interacting massive particle dark matter sort of lies somewhere like in here. So part of my motivation in showing this to you is to say that we shouldn't get too restricted to a certain class of dark matter candidate. That being said, there are reasons to prefer things that are happening sort of in the mass range that is accessible to the standard model. Part of it is this Tremaine-Gunn bound. Part of it is the observation that weakly interacting massive particles make sense. But in everything that we're doing in this course, you should keep in mind that there are probably a lot of very interesting unexplored possibilities that are going on here, and that in principle, we want to find ways of figuring out what dark matter is no matter where it lies along this whole continuum. All right, so the next step is we want to find a way of taking a particle theory and mapping it onto a dark matter abundance. This will allow us to see what properties of this theory give us the correct abundance. And then that allows us, in turn, to look for it and give us implication for experiments. OK. Are there any questions about any of this? Yes.
So there's no other narrowing of the mass scale? Or because where there's like the detectors, do people just like look generically on the whole scale? Or else like somebody has some like hypothesis that's supposed to be like in some like narrower area? So
you bring up a good point, which is that at best, experiments to look for dark matter cover sort of a few orders of magnitude and mass range. So when you hear about these news articles, oh, they didn't discover dark matter at xenon or what, the LHC or whatever, they're talking about very, very narrow band. And this is actually something that's become sort of a a realization of the past 5 years, which is that we haven't discovered supersymmetry, we haven't discovered the things that people say we should look for at the weak scale, and pretty much everyone had been assuming dark matter was going to be at the weak scale. And so all of the experimental effort had gone that direction. And it was observed that by, you know, if you're looking for things in these other mass ranges, because no one had even thought to look for them, you can make a lot of advances with very limited technology set. That's one of the focuses of the researchers here, is to think more broadly and say, okay, using some, you know, at experiments that are already being done or some cheap ones, how do we kind of fill in some of the other gaps and make sure we're not missing something just by very narrowly focusing on one part of the mass range? But yeah, that's exactly the problem that we face. Yes?
In terms of your, I had a question about your stability criteria.
Okay.
So it's just, I mean, so I imagine even if it can be done, it probably took a lot of knowledge and effort to show stability of stuff that we know very well
mm-hmm.
from the standard model.
Okay.
Does that sound approximately right? I'm not like an expert.
So can you clarify that maybe? Like to show the stability of which part of
like any large composite, like protons or...
So, yeah, so actually, the standard model is sort of a good example of how you can get stable things. So the reason why protons are stable is that there is what's called an accidental symmetry of the standard model, which is that if I write down all of the interactions that are consistent with gauge invariance, then I find that there's a conservation of something called baryon number, which is, baryon number is defined as each quark has charge of 1/3, and Q bar has charge of minus 1/3. And all of the interactions that involve quarks look like there's the gauge kinetic term, and then there's the Higgs terms. So there's like Q Higgs U conjugate plus Q Higgs star D conjugate. And if you look at all of these, the Qs and Q bars always come in pairs. Okay. So what this tells you is that the things that have a net baryon number can never decay. Okay. Or they can only decay into something that has baryon number of the same charge. So a proton, which is made up of a U quark, a D quark, and a D quark, sorry, two U quarks and a D quark, this has baryon charge of plus one. So it can never decay in the standard model. So what the lesson that this should tell us is that the stability of things in the standard model seems to come from some symmetry principle. And so hopefully, if dark matter is stable, there's also some symmetry principle that we can write down that just immediately forbids it from decaying. Okay. You can do the same thing for electrons. There's a thing called lepton number, which electrons have charge plus one and anti-electrons have charge negative one. And there's a similar kind of argument you can make. Does that answer your question?
I mean, I would still contend that like a large amount of, there's still a lot that I would imagine we can't at least like analytically expect to show stability of from the standard model, right?
Sure. Well, so.
I mean, I could just keep getting bigger and eventually you'd have to say, yes, okay, I can show stability of whatever, that. I guess I was just going to ask, would you really expect, I mean, if you're just coming up with a theory for the first time, would you really expect like stability to be something that would be easy to see? Like, you see what I mean?
I see what you're saying. And I agree with you that this is the reason why these symmetry arguments are the most powerful ones. Because if I have a symmetry that protects it, then as long as the interactions I write down preserve that symmetry, then it can never decay. And that's certainly true in the standard model as well, that if you start extending the standard model, for instance, in supersymmetry or other things, then you do violate baryon number and you do get proton decay. So the simplest way to stabilize the proton is to just make it a symmetry, baryon number, a symmetry of your theory, and then you're done. But you're right, that if you don't have a symmetry, then you have to worry, you know, what if some interaction that I haven't thought about can cause it to decay? And so the way that usually theorists deal with it is by saying, okay, I'm just going to forbid everything that causes it to decay. And then it's kind of stable by fiats. And then that can have certain implications for, say, how you produce dark matter or what its interactions are. Any other questions? Okay, so I'll see you tomorrow morning.